I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Ajit Pai, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, wrote in the Wall Street Journal last week that he wanted to repeal net neutrality because of what he called President Obama's heavy-handed internet regulations. This was right before Thanksgiving, so chances are you were more concerned about whether or not to dry brine the turkey than pay attention to the news. The FCC will vote on this proposal on December 14th. If passed, critics say this is a big win for big broadband companies and a big loss for smaller rival companies and for consumers. Net neutrality was set up to ensure that providers treat all content equally by not slowing it down, not charging more for delivery, and not blocking it. Cory Doctorow, co-editor of Boing Boing, has been following this story, and he joins us on Radio Times. Cory, nice to have you with us on the show.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. What has net neutrality meant for consumers?
Well, since 2005 and the very first net neutrality rules, it's meant that the companies that enjoy natural and sometimes legislative monopolies over how we use the internet have had a relatively high level of assurance that the company whose job it is to connect you to the rest of the world don't get to decide what you can see and don't get to shape your experience of the whole world of the internet based on what's best for their shareholders instead of what's best for you and our society.
Is it treating it then like a utility, like electricity, for instance?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in the context of the FCC rule, that absolutely, that's what Title II is about. It's about invoking the rules that apply to utilities to the carriers that carry our internet traffic. But I think that there's a deeper philosophical basis for this, which is that, like, these companies that provide internet access to us, they don't do it with their own money. They do it with our public subsidy. If you were, like, going to set up Verizon in New York City and you were going to buy the right to dig up every block of sidewalk in New York and go into every basement in New York, and then you were going to buy the right to run poles all the way from New York to Los Angeles, and you were going to buy that at public clearing prices from private landowners all the way across, you would spend $10 trillion and you would still not have a network that was finished. So what you have to do is come hat in hand to the taxpayer and say, you guys own this precious asset, the rights of way and the power of eminent domain. Will you please give us trillions of dollars in subsidy to give us a network? And we say yes, and we say the quid pro quo for that is that you have to allow us to connect to the services that we ask for as quickly as possible. You know, if you want to go Galt and build your own network and pay for all of that wire and all that right of way, then by all means do, and then you can tell us what we can see. But it's facially obvious that when you click on a website, what you want is that website, not the website that the carrier wishes you would click on.
Let me quote something else from Ajit Pai from his Wall Street Journal commentary of last week. He says, talking about what he describes as burdensome regulation has failed consumers and businesses alike. The effect has been particularly serious for smaller internet service providers. They don't have the time, money, or lawyers to cut through a thicket of complex rules. Any truth to that from your perspective?
Well, it's empirically not true. And, you know, in the famous saying, he's entitled to his own opinion, but not his own facts. So after Title II came in, we saw what happened to investment in infrastructure. It went up. Not only did it go up, but all of the giant carriers who are lobbying to get rid of net neutrality on the grounds that it undermines their investment, they made shareholder disclosures. They got on the phone with these conference calls, and the CEOs of these companies said, well, you know, in the lead up to Title II, we said we wouldn't do as much investment, but we're totally doing as much investment, and we're going to do more, and it's had no effect on our investment. So, you know, I guess, like, who are you going to believe, Ajit Pai or your own lying eyes, right? You know, we heard them say it, so that's how we know it's true. The regulation is not burdensome. The regulation says that when I click on a web page, you try and give me that web page as best as you can, right, instead of checking a table to see whether that web page paid you a bribe to reach me more quickly.
Is net neutrality going away? We've got Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, a Trump appointee. He's a Republican. The FCC made up of five members, three Republicans, two Democrats. Are we going to see net neutrality disappear?
You know, when the Trump administration took office, there was a lot of stuff we thought was a foregone conclusion, like Obamacare repeal and so on. And it turns out that if you are in the political business of proving that government is incompetent and you have spent years and years trying to make government as incompetent and incapable as possible, that when you come in to administer, you tend to make a kind of shambles of it. And so we've seen that so far, and we see it with this Ajit Pai order or draft order. It goes so far in peeling back the net neutrality rules that it violates existing Supreme Court law on when and how the expert agencies of the administration can act. So the Supreme Court says, if you're an expert agency like the FCC or the FTC or the EPA or whatever, you have to act on the basis of evidence, not ideology. And so all the things that the FCC has done so far, like bringing in Title II rules, they had to show evidence that there was a problem in order to get those rules in place. Now, in order for the FCC today to get rid of those rules, they have to show evidence that the facts that led to the Title II rule have changed. And there is no evidence that those facts have materially changed in a way that would militate for striking down the Title II rules. Rather, what we've seen is even more market concentration. We've seen more carriers wanting to buy more media companies that would produce more anti-competitive effects, like the Time Warner AT&T merger that's you know, waiting there in the wings. And so, you know, in the absence of evidence, it seems pretty likely that the courts are not going to look favorably on this. And given that there is a likely change in Congress coming in about a year, if this is held at bay for a year, it seems like it would just open the door for Congress to come in and slap the administration around for trying to make a change in ideology equivalent to a change in reality.
I mean, it seems like you're saying that no matter what they decide, it could make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I think it will make its way to the courts, if nothing else. You know, we think that, like, I beg your pardon, I just blew my buffer there. Sorry, it's 7 a.m. here on the East Coast, on the West Coast.
Okay.
You know, I think it's not enough to say that the courts will eventually knock this down, therefore we don't have to pay attention to it. As Tim Wu wrote in the New York Times this week, what we have to rely on is that the courts are consequentialists. They have their finger on the pulse of public opinion, and things that cause the public conscience to recoil in horror are things that the courts look unfavorably upon. And so to the extent that it becomes a cause celeb, that this unbelievably boring but incredibly important technical issue clears that most improbable of hurdles and becomes a public issue of real moment, the courts are going to pay attention to it in the same way that climate eventually overcame kind of the indifference and the technological complexity of it and eventually became an issue that's on everybody's lips. As net neutrality and other issues like it are becoming more and more significant to the public discourse, the courts are becoming more consequentialist, and they're thinking it through, and where they find themselves in a position where they could swing one way or the other, they tend to side with the public. They don't want to discredit the judicial system by making it seem so out of touch with the public view. And I know we're running out of time. I wonder if I could give you a really good example of that.
Sure, go ahead.
If you'd indulge me.
Sure.
So there was an 8-year fight over whether or not the VCR should be legal from 1976 to 1984, and it was this knockdown, drag-out battle that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And when it started, nobody knew what a VCR was, and no one could tell what would happen to the movie industry by the time it was it became a mature technology. But in 1984, when the Supremes ruled on it, there were 6 million VCRs in America's living room. Those judges had all like sat in their families, in their relatives' houses, and watched movies on VCRs. They'd driven past video rental stores to get to the court that morning. And if they had voted to ban a technology in 6 million Americans' living rooms that morning, they would have seemed so out of touch with the lived reality of Americans that it would have brought the whole judiciary into disrepute. We are approaching that moment for net neutrality and other internet regulations. We're starting to realize that the internet is not a glorified video on demand service or a pornography distribution service or a jihadi recruiting system. It's the nervous system of the 21st century. And as we go past peak indifference, we have a better chance than ever of getting the courts to see our side.
You mentioned AT&T. I'm thinking of Comcast, Time Warner, Cox. There are other broadband companies. How do you see them and the role that they are playing? They clearly want what Ajit Pai wants.
Well, you know, it's funny. If you look at what Comcast wrote in the run-up to the last round of regulation, the Tom Wheeler AT&T, or the Tom Wheeler net neutrality rules in 2015-2016, they filed all these notices with the FCC and made all these shareholder disclosures and made these public pronouncements saying, we don't need net neutrality regulation because we are a neutral carrier anyway. And they made all these promises about what they would do. And one of those promises was that they would never create internet slow lanes and threaten companies with being doomed to the internet slow lanes unless they paid a bribe to get into the fast lane. Mm. And they this week spammed all of social media. You've probably seen it if you're on Twitter. They've got all these promoted posts that make all of their net neutrality promises, and they reiterate three of the four promises they made in 2014-2015, but they omit this internet slow lane promise. And so it tells you what their promises are worth. You know, Laura Sjoberg, who's a Wired commentator, wrote a follow-up to this that went viral on Twitter, where he said, you know, we promise that we will never, ever do these bad things, but we absolutely must have the right to do these bad things, even though we promise we'll never do them. You know, if they're never going to do them, then this rule shouldn't have any impact on them.
Well, it seems to me we know from the past you do not want to anger people who support net neutrality. They will rise up. Yes, Corey?
Well, I think that, you know, the internet matters so much to so many people in so many ways. And you know, it's just always clear that when a cable operator or a phone company wants to do something that requires these kinds of machinations in smoke-filled rooms, that they're not doing it because they want you to be pleasantly surprised and so they're just bypassing the democratic norms. They're doing it because they're the worst companies in America, right? And literally, like Consumers Union, when they hold these votes about who's the worst company in America, Comcast comes out on top all the time. You know, this is the company that takes 3 hours to unsubscribe from. And AT&T, that's the company that used to charge you extra money for your caller ID if you wanted to see who was calling you when you picked up the phone. You know, imagine what that would look like if AT&T could control your email, right? Reading the from line before you open the email in your inbox would cost extra money. They think that, like, anything that you can do that's new, that brings new value to the network, is something that they should be able to monetize by withholding from you unless you pay for it. And that's antithetical to the internet. The idea of the internet is that anyone who has a cool idea for making the wire that comes into your house do more for you can do it. And that's how we got here. If they get to discriminate among services, then they get to choose the services that cooperate with them to monetize their wire by charging you for stuff that right now you get for free. They transfer the value of the internet from you to them.
And we're almost out of time here. So what do you think is going to happen on December 14th?
Oh, I think Ajit Pai is going to bring down an unrealistic, crazy, enraging, arrogant, net neutrality destroying rule, and that the internet is going to rise up in a mass fury, and that it's going to end up in court, and it's also going to end up with huge public pressure on companies like Verizon and Comcast. We'll see more public protests in front of their offices. I think their senior tech people are going to look themselves in the mirror, like the CTO of the MPAA did after the SOPA fight, and they're going to say, I can't do this job anymore, and they're going to quit, because honestly, you know, those people have kids and those people's kids use the internet, and they're going to grow up and inherit an internet that
Corey,
is either controlled
we
by
gotta say goodbye
themselves.
Thank you for getting up early. That's Corey Doctorow,
no problem,
co-editor of Boing Boing. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, we were just talking about an upcoming FCC vote to repeal net neutrality, a proposal pushed by Ajit Pai, chair of the FCC appointed by President Trump. This is just one example of how the Trump administration is changing the media landscape. The FCC just repealed a rule that opens the door to more media consolidation, letting a few companies own more local TV stations, radio stations, and newspapers. For example, Sinclair Broadcasting Group wants to merge with Tribune Media, which would give it control of more than 200 TV stations and a platform for its pro-Trump commentaries. While the Justice Department is blocking the sale of Time Warner to AT&T, Time Incorporated was just bought by the Meredith Corporation for almost $3 billion, with $650 million from the Koch brothers' equity arm. Meanwhile, the president recently lambasted CNN International and got in an argument with Time Magazine over this year's Person of the Year. We asked Andy Kroll to join us. He's a reporter for Mother Jones, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Andy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Also with us, Meg James got up early. She's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, where she covers corporate media and the business of TV. Meg James, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Andy, let me begin with you. We were just talking about net neutrality, that if it goes away, it looks like it would be a win for AT&T. And we also have the Justice Department blocking AT&T's merger with Time Warner. How do you understand what's going on in the Trump administration?
Well, it's hard to understand when you look at those particular moves that you just mentioned, the net neutrality announcement from the chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, and if you line that up against the AT&T Time Warner merger, the logics seem to completely conflict with each other. One seems to be protecting the little guy and saying that this kind of consolidation is not something that the Justice Department supports in the case of Time Warner and AT&T, that these two companies should not be one. And then the other hand, you have the FCC with its net neutrality draft decision, and also with the moves that you've described, a sort of campaign of deregulating the broadcast business, saying mergers are important. This is the future of media. This is the future of media in the digital era. And this is what needs to be done to ensure a thriving broadcast or media business, whatever the FCC's talking points are. So there's this sort of double-mind kind of approach that you see in the Trump administration, and it's hard not to look at these decisions and see possibly the hand of politics, political influence, the president obviously being a vocal opponent of CNN, tweeting out images of CNN getting beat up in wrestling rings, and at the same time his FCC knocking down one barrier after another for a more favorable, more friendly company in the case of Sinclair Broadcast Group, growing its reach and adding to its already large empire of television stations.
And I want to pick up on all of that. Meg, let me get you in on the conversation. First of all, why do you think AT&T wants to buy Time Warner? And how does CNN factor into whatever decision is made?
Well, this is one of the probably the best mysteries in media right now. AT&T, more than a year ago, it was in October of 2016, announced this $85 billion bid for Time Warner. And the reason why is that AT&T's core businesses, selling phone service, selling television service, is really plateauing. They're not getting growth in new subscribers because people who are going to get a smartphone or pay TV subscription have already purchased it, and we've seen intense competition in the phone market. So AT&T is looking at the landscape, and they're seeing what people are using on their phones. They're enjoying entertainment, they're reading news, they're watching news videos and other videos, and they see, aha, that this is where the market is moving. It's moving towards, content, and that's becoming more valuable than the distribution systems, i.e. DirecTV or their phones. And so they want to get in on that game. They want to be able to own the content that they, sell advertising off of, because they see that as being a huge market, and they want to remain relevant.
Well, and Time Warner is the parent company of CNN, so that's where Mega gets, curiouser and curiouser?
Yeah, no, it's really quite fascinating because, I've been covering this merger, since it was announced, and all the parties involved thought that they were headed for a quick approval from the Justice Department. They did not have to get the FCC's approval because there weren't any TV stations involved, but Time Warner is one of the biggest media companies. It owns Warner Brothers Studios, which produces The Big Bang Theory. They own TBS and TNT, which has sports and other programming. And they also own HBO, which, is huge premium programming. programming and CNN. And Trump has made no secret of his disdain for CNN. And so here we have the situation where over the summer everyone assumes, oh, this is going to get approved in September. I even did a big story about how AT&T had already announced the new leadership to take over Time Warner. And at the end of September, Megan Delharim, which was President Trump's pick to run the antitrust division of the Justice Department, takes office, and all of a sudden there was a noticeable shift. Now, you can say, well, was the Justice Department preparing to try to block this mega merger, or is it because Trump doesn't like CNN?
Amen. Well, interestingly, and this goes back, Andy, to the campaign where Trump campaigned saying he is opposed this merger. We also know how much he disdains not just the media, but CNN in particular. Is this all about how Trump feels about CNN, do you think?
It's hard not to see President Trump's influence, President Trump's very public, very vocal opinions about CNN coming into play in the in the debate and in the whole shakeout of this massive deal. I mean, President Trump has been railed against CNN from early on in his presidential campaign. He has carried on doing it right through the obviously his election, the inauguration, his presidency. Not a week seems to go by when he doesn't tweet about CNN. Tweets, I would add, that will no doubt find their way into litigation as the commander-in-chief, top executive of this country, singling out CNN in putting this in the context of this AT&T Time Warner deal. So it's not it's not hard to see the president's influence here. Obviously, the Justice Department has denied and surely will continue to deny that there was any sort of political influence, any sort of political consideration in its decision, but that I don't know if that passes the straight face test, as they would say in a courtroom.
Well, you mentioned a tweet. Here's one from the president just this past weekend at Fox News. It's much more important in the United States than CNN, but outside the U.S., CNN International is still a major source of, quote, fake news, and they represent our nation to the world very poorly. The outside world does not see the truth from them. Shortly after that, we hear that President Vladimir Putin signed, and I'm quoting from the New York Times here, signed a law that requires certain American media outlets working in Russia to register with the government as foreign agents, essentially identifying them as hostile entities. Mr. Putin's allies had previously signaled that CNN International could be affected. I don't want to get paranoid here, Meg, but it's hard not to connect the dots.
It is. And then I think that's really what's going on here, is there's been so much public vitriol about CNN. Now you see this Putin move in Russia, and people are left scratching their heads. It's like, is this the reason why the Justice Department is moving to block this merger? Now, that said, there's a lot of consumer advocates who are saying, like, time out. This merger would be bad.
Right.
You have the types like Elizabeth Warren, Al Franken, Bernie Sanders, who have spoken out about this merger for some time. But it's just very, curious, to use your word, that suddenly we have this situation where the Justice Department and Trump seem to be aligned with some of the most liberal senators in Congress.
What do you make of that, Andy?
Well, I make of it several points I'd make on it. I mean, it's the CNN International tweet that you mentioned is troubling to the point that it makes you want to go walk around outside to take a walk and get fresh air, because it's so unbelievable, obviously singling out Fox News for an incredible amount of praise, as the president has done time and time again. The timing, as you mentioned, of this criticism of CNN International after, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has cracked down on American media, foreign media in his country. And it's hard not to read that tweet of the president and see it as an effort to show that he is like President Putin, or at least some kind of, gesture of not sympathy, but siding with Putin.
Yeah.
Yes, solidarity is exactly the word. Thank you, Meg. a gesture of solidarity, which, again, is something that this president has done in other ways on a number of occasions, and it's completely antithetical to the First Amendment, freedom of the press. And so it is extremely troubling statement from the president, timing and substance.
Well, let me just quote a couple of more tweets. This comes from CNN Communications, and I do want to move on from here as well, but I think these are worth reading. CNN Communications saying it's not CNN's job to represent the U.S. to the world. That's yours, referring to the president. Our job is to report the news. Christiane Amanpour said, at CNN, we dodge bullets to bring you the news. Nothing fake about that. And it goes on and on from there. But it's clear that the president's warfare with the media continues. And Meg, it doesn't seem as this is not something he's going to change or back down from. And I think it appeals very directly to his supporters.
Oh, of course. And you know, Trump could get a tremendous amount of political capital if he was able to block this merger, even though technically it wouldn't be Trump that was blocking it. It would be a judge in a U.S. District Court in Washington. But amongst, you know, his followers, he could, you know, hold this up as, you know, standing up to what he calls fake news. It would also, to Andy's point, show him on sort of equal footing, if not more so, than Putin, who's also cracking down on the press. So there's so many fascinating angles that, you know, we have yet to explore. And if this AT&T, you know, case goes to trial, I think it would be, you know, most fascinating, because AT&T has said, well, we don't know if it's Trump involved, but it's very, you know, suspicious. And so they would have discovery. They'd be able to, you know, ask the Justice Department to see whether or not they could prove a case that, you know, there was some involvement with Trump. And as it stands right now, you know, it's, you know, whether or not this deal goes through will be argued on the legal merits, but the legal experts that I talked to, the antitrust experts, said that AT&T has been handed a gift with all these tweets from President Trump, because it does, you know, suggest that there is, you know, some sort of heavy hand of his influence.
Andy, let me put something else out here. The FCC made another decision, or made a decision essentially, to eliminate a lot of the regulations about local media ownership. How does that open the door to Sinclair, and what should we know about Sinclair itself?
Basically, from the moment that the Trump administration began, the FCC, again, under the chairmanship of Ajit Pai, a Republican member of the commission, was named the chairman earlier this year by President Trump. The Pai FCC has just knocked down one rule, one law, one regulation after another regarding the broadcast business, ownership of it, you know, how you regulate it, how big broadcast companies can be. And when you put together the chronology of all that the commission has done this year, the company that comes out, you know, looking the best, or the company that comes out with the most benefit, the biggest winner of this whole bonanza of deregulation at the FCC, is the company Sinclair Broadcast Group. It is a company that a lot of Americans have not heard of. It is not like Fox News, where you tune your, you know, cable box, your satellite dish to the Sinclair channel. No, what Sinclair does is it owns almost 200 TV broadcast stations around the country, your local television news, and it is looking to expand its footprint even larger by merging with Tribune Media, based out of Chicago. This is a blockbuster $4 billion deal that would make Sinclair far and away the largest broadcast company in the country. It would give it stations in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the three biggest media markets in the country. And it would give the company, Sinclair, a platform for this pro-Trump commentary, this pro-Trump programming that is a trademark of Sinclair in the past decade.
In fact, let me play a commentary. And this is a former Trump campaign official. He's also a current commentator for Sinclair Broadcasting Group. This is Boris Epstein on his Bottom Line with Boris Epstein commentary. It's a segment that aired on September 20th.
America first. We've talked about it before. It is a very catchy phrase. Most importantly, President Trump continues to prove that there is some real substance and action behind the slogan. The president did so again this week when he spoke to the United Nations General Assembly for the first time. While this is a long-standing tradition for U.S. presidents, Donald Trump's tone was starkly different than that of his predecessors. President Trump pulled no punches. The president directly called out North Korea and Iran for their actions in destabilizing their regions and the world. The key word from the speech? Sovereignty. President Trump emphasized that maintaining sovereignty, independence, is the correct path for the U.S. and for all countries around the world.
Andy, are these stations required to carry that commentary, and is that unusual?
They are required to carry it. These are called must-run segments. In the broadcast business, must-run segments of this nature, you know, I mean, that clip you played, you know, could basically have been produced by the White House itself. It is just so slavishly pro-Trump. These segments are very uncommon in the broadcast business, almost unheard of outside of Sinclair. It's not uncommon for a must-run segment on a different, you know, with a different broadcast company to be something about a local promotion or a, you know, happy holidays from a general manager at a station. But this hardline political analysis, commentary, whatever you want to, propaganda is how it's been described by some television critics. This is unique to Sinclair, and it's something that they are have not only introduced with the likes of Boris Epstein and other folks on their channel, but it's something that they have doubled down on and have increased this year as the Trump presidency has progressed.
But does it also tell us that they believe that local TV still has a large influence on, if not voters, certainly its viewers?
They do believe that, and they're right in a pretty good sense there. I mean, if you look at studies by Pew, for instance, local television, believe it or not, in the era of Google and Facebook and Twitter, still has a tremendous power to shape public opinion. It also still remains, though not as much as it was in decades past, a profitable business, which is why you see Sinclair going into big deals like this Tribune deal for $4 billion, which is why you see it snapping up stations around the country. It is still a lucrative business. And this company, again, Sinclair, with this strong pro-Trump bent, is poised to just completely dominate the business if this Tribune deal goes through.
We are talking about the changes in the media landscape in the last year or so under the Trump administration. That's Andy Kroll joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. He's a reporter for Mother Jones. And joining us from California is Meg James. She's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She covers corporate media and the business of TV. We want to hear from you. Any questions or comments to join our conversation? Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Comments coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Andy Kroll of Mother Jones and Meg James of the Los Angeles Times about the changing media landscape under the Trump administration, a number of decisions or upcoming decisions by the FCC, and some questions about mergers as well. Here's an email from Bob. He says, one of my concerns is that if the Republicans run this through, that large providers will do their usual quid pro quo and essentially try to block any dissent or opposite views. Meg, do you share Bob's concerns?
Well, I think Bob must be speaking about the net neutrality or perhaps the merger.
Sure.
I think that there's a lot of concern, and I think your previous segment was talking about net neutrality.
Yes.
And how this has been something that's protected internet traffic so that it is a equal playing field. I mean, there's been organizations like Etsy, the craft site online, which, you know, they've said that, you know, if net neutrality comes through, they might not be able to compete against, you know, more deep-pocketed companies like Amazon or even Michael's, you know, the craft store. So I think there's real issues about, you know, and why I think people are concerned because media is so important. It influences opinion. And so I think if you have the government that is really, you know, putting a heavy hand on it, it does raise questions about, you know, us as a society.
Well, and it's interesting to have this conversation knowing about some of the allegations or questions involving Facebook and Google and some of these other sites, Andy, where a lot of people get a lot, if not their news, certainly information.
Yeah, I mean, it's the numbers about how people get their information and the percentage of people, especially younger people who get their information through social media, are astounding. And they're only increasing. And that raises a whole host of questions in terms of how, you know, Facebook both polices what, if that's the right word, or monitors, oversees what appears on its platform, how it takes measures to combat, say, Russian interference, obviously a huge story coming out of the 2016 presidential election and continuing to today, and how Facebook, I mean, the biggest thing for me, and as someone who's, you know, been in, worked in media for a decade, as Facebook has become, you know, this dominant player in my life and, you know, how the organization that I work for finds readers, is that Facebook makes these changes to its algorithms, to its news feed. Obviously, that's the stream of information right down the middle of your Facebook page. And they make these changes, and there's very little transparency often about why they've done it, what they've done, how that's going to play out. You've seen media organizations, websites that have seen their traffic just vanish overnight because of a change to the almighty Facebook algorithm. So there's so many thorny questions here. I mean, in Twitter, we could go into that as well, especially when it comes to the sort of foreign interference and all the questions that raises. But that's a whole nother segment, to be honest.
Well, and we've done whole shows about that. But I just, as we're talking about all of these changes, we just need to be able to fold some of that stuff in. Let me read another tweet. In the era of Trump administration deregulation, we actually need more/new regulations on social media, especially around political messages. Andy, someone agreeing with you. Meg, let me put something else on the table as we talk about this changing media landscape. Sure. This is Meredith Corporation just recently bought Time Incorporated. They spent something like $3 billion, but $650 million of that came from a private equity arm of the Koch brothers. Does that mean that the Koch brothers are controlling this buy, but also could be controlling content?
Well, that's another fascinating story, because Meredith is the publisher of Better Homes and Gardens and Family Circle and very middle of the country leaning magazines that have done quite well and prospered. For years, they've been interested in buying Time Inc., which owns Time, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, People magazine, which continues to be a real cash cow. But Meredith couldn't pull off the deal until just, you know, this month. The deal was unveiled on Sunday night, and lo and behold, the Koch brothers are investing $650 million. Mm-hmm. Now, sensitive to, you know, the concerns that the Koch brothers, you know, might want to use Time and Fortune, you know, to shape public opinion, Meredith has said that, no, the Koch brothers are not going to have a seat on the board. They're going to be passive investors, and we're just going to continue to, you know, run things the way we would run things without the Koch brothers. But you really have to ask yourself, in this environment when print media is really struggling, how good of an investment is that for these very smart, you know, shrewd brothers? If they don't get to, you know, have some sort of an input, why would they be investing that much money in a business that clearly is struggling if they don't get something else out of it?
Well, we certainly know their support for libertarian and conservative causes. Meg, that's an interesting way to put it, which if you're going to put that much money into an investment, what do you want in return? Andy, how do you see this?
I see it on a couple of levels. One is, having written about the Koch brothers and their political philanthropic enterprise for a number of years now, you know, what Meg says is definitely right, which is it's hard to see why Koch would make an investment of this size and remain purely on the sidelines, purely passive, staying out of this completely, given their history. I mean, there's a handful of former Time editors, Rick Stengel, among others, who have said that we would be naive to think that the Koch brothers aren't going to have any kind of influence, even without a seat on the board. The seat on the board is what Meredith seems to be saying to ward off these, critiques of the deal and observations about the Kochs. But I think that Rick Stengel, the former editor of Time, would know that well. The other point that I would make is, you know, Meredith is not a media company, a magazine company known for news or sports. They are a company known for the titles that Meg mentioned, Better Homes and Gardens being an obvious one. And there's a possibility as well that the big titles that we know of, us news junkies follow closely, like Time and Sports Illustrated and Fortune and so on, they get sold off by Meredith, that they don't remain in the company and some other entity comes into play. There was this piece in the Daily Beast today suggesting that possibly the company behind the National Enquirer could go in for Time or go in for Sports Illustrated. Obviously, the company behind National Enquirer, I believe it's American Media, if I've got that right.
That's Enquirer with an E, right?
Enquirer with an E, yes, exactly. Chills down your spine.
It sure does.
Yeah, that
which
you know
also,
they bought Menstrual.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
The National Enquirer also has some ties to President Trump, so it's this big circle that we're seeing with Trump having, if not his real influence, just sort of the suggestion of one, and that makes things fascinating too. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Andy.
No, totally correct. Correct.
But it's interesting to think of this merger or this buy, knowing that a number of magazines, and I think Time itself, has had, you know, sagging revenues, sagging readership. It's a curious thing to want to buy in 2017. Any thoughts on that, Andy?
It is a curious buy, and there's an element of curiosity and mystery behind this deal as well, especially in the case of this $650 million of financing from the investment arm of Koch Industries. It's hard to look at the public terms of the deal as they are now, look at the health of Time Magazine and you know that Newsweekly style of magazine in the first place and think that there is not some ulterior motive to this. Maybe Meredith, which doesn't, I believe, publish any weekly titles right now, maybe Meredith decides to make a sort of more of a monthly out of some of these new titles that it's coming into possession of. Maybe, again, it tries to offload Time or Sports Illustrated. Maybe the Kochs see this as a way. The Kochs have made a play or seemingly made a play for media in the past. They were rumored to be looking at Tribune Company newspapers, and that deal never came through. So media is something that has been on their radar for years now, and it's hard to think that they would put that kind of money up without hoping to get some kind of influence out of it.
Let me see what Joseph from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. Joseph, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. So I'm interested in this conversation because of the way it's being framed about how the media landscape is changing. Since President Trump announced his candidacy for presidency back in 2015, the media has been like obsessed or to the borderline addiction with Trump. It's been like Trump 24/7. And I'm wondering, has the media, what do they think of their role as evolving? Like, how can the media, like, creatively combat and take a more active role in changing it, but for the better? Has anyone considered, you know, denying him coverage as one,
well,
you know, example?
Sure, James. Excuse me, Joseph. And it's something that we've talked about on Radio Times. But, Meg, is there something the media, such as it is, can do? There's certainly a lot of in-depth journalism taking place.
Oh my goodness, and I think that's a great question because if you look at what industries have benefited the most from Trump's presidency, I think you would have to rank the media right up there. I mean, CNN's ratings have been through the roof, the New York Times, the Washington Post, my publication, the Los Angeles Times, have seen a huge, you know, surge in paid online memberships, because people see the value of, you know, strong reporting. So I think that the media is sort of, to use your caller's point, addicted to Trump because it's great ratings, it's great television. And, you know, if we were to, you know, segue to another presidency, say a Mike Pence or someone like that, it might suddenly seem so boring that everyone would be missing Donald Trump. So I don't think you're going to see the media sort of back away from Trump. And also, I mean, the stories that, you know, we write that have some Trump element do so much better than, you know, stories about process. And so people are really interested. So I guess we have to think about it as it's a great moment for people to learn more about democracy and our leadership and even media.
Well, and Andy, there's a tricky balancing act between covering President Trump and enabling President Trump.
There is, and I love that Joseph called up and asked us that question because it's a subject that has been on my mind God, for almost a couple of years now. I mean, I remember I went on a trip to Laredo, Texas, when then-candidate Trump did his first much-vaunted border tour, which was really this weird sort of two-and-a-half-hour media circus to the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas. And I remember coming out of that trip and these questions of, you know, how is this guy going to be covered? How is the media going to respond to him? They lodged in my mind, and they've been there ever since. I hate to be the member of the media who tisks his colleagues, but I'll tisk myself too, to try to be fair about it, because I write a lot about Trump. By which I'll say that I think that the media has done an incredible job reporting on his administration. I think it has also covered him to the point of obsession. And there needs to be, you know, if I put on my media critic hat, just a little more sort of introspection about, or self-reflection, self-analysis, self-critique even, about, is all of this coverage absolutely vital and necessary? Are there other ways to do it? Are there smarter ways to do it? Are there elements of the Trump administration that aren't getting the attention that they should because we're writing about his latest tweet, or we're writing about something he said at a press conference that was inflammatory and ridiculous, but maybe not, you know, meriting the wall-to-wall coverage that it got.
Almost out of time here, but I do want to put something else on the table. As we know, the Washington Post has been doing some deep investigations in Alabama into Roy Moore's candidacy for the U.S. Senate. And there was really a fascinating piece. I suggest people watch this video. A woman named Jamie Phillips approached one of the Washington Post reporters saying she had a salacious story on Roy Moore. And you see the Washington Post reporter ask hard questions, and they didn't post the story. They didn't find the woman to be credible. I think a good example of good journalism. And then there's also this another Washington Post reporter talking with James O'Keefe. He's the founder of Project Veritas, about this woman. And again, a very interesting exchange, a back and forth of what journalism is and what it isn't. Any thoughts on that?
It's many thoughts on it. I mean, I've had a few run-ins with James O'Keefe myself, both, you know, writing about his hijinks, and, you know, in some cases, my publication has, had run-ins with his operatives, if you could call them that, as well. I mean, this is the one of a number of occasions in which Project Veritas and O'Keefe have sort of stepped on their own toes or fallen flat on their faces. You know, there was a great New Yorker piece about a fake voicemail message, I believe it was, with a potential sting target, in which O'Keefe forgot to hang up the phone and then proceeded to tell his colleagues all about how this sting was going to happen. And I think the story is called Sting of Myself, I believe. What's troubling is that, you know, this is a concerted, continued campaign to try to discredit reporters doing their job, doing the best work they can, holding the powerful accountable. And it's a reminder that we have to be doubly cautious and doubly rigorous with our work to make sure that the facts are right, that the people we talk to are who they say they are, and that we're getting the real story and not some baited political effort from someone with a partisan angle.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Andy Kroll, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's a reporter for Mother Jones. Meg James, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And she's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And I did post what we were just talking about with James O'Keefe on our Facebook page. You should check it out. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.